James chapter 4, verses 11 through 17. The ninth talk in a series on the book of James was presented by Rusty Rexius on October 8, 2017 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2017. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
So I am finishing up a series on James. The funny thing about that is I've been through this book one other time publicly, and I never finished, and I realized I never finished because I never knew what to do with the end, and it was just sort of easier to just quit. So my preference would have been to have quit, but I didn't, so I have either 3 or 4 weeks worth of stuff to talk about with this funny letter, book, missive. I'm not sure exactly. I'm more convinced that I know what it is, but we'll finish that up here in 3 or 4 weeks. I hope this is actually helpful. I just wrote, it's not really a story, but I just wrote an introduction, not so much to James particularly, but a way to set the stage that, at least for me, it helps sort of orient us to why this thing is even written, and to whom it was written, the circumstances sort of surrounding its writing. So I'm just going to read this. I thought about actually memorizing it, but I decided that would take me way too much time, so I didn't. So I'm going to read this. It's just a page. Hopefully it's helpful in setting the stage. It is somewhere between 40 and 60 AD, 10 to 30 years since Jesus was crucified, raised, and ascended. Since the time of the Messiah Jesus, his arrival then departure, the Messianic Jewish community, the Jewish church, has grown somewhat dramatically. Time out, everybody. It's time to do this. Has grown somewhat dramatically to the point where, at least in the mind of the non-believing Jewish community, that is the establishment, this movement, this Jesus movement, is a threat. Primarily, a threat to the establishment's comfortable way of life under current Roman rule, but also a threat to most everything they have believed about how their God, Yahweh, had chosen to favor those and only those who held tightly to the words and the letters on that stone their God had given to Moses. In a sentence, they believed that Yahweh would reward Jews and only Jews who simply did the 613 instructions that he provided. Never mind at all what those 613 instructions were given to represent. It was simply a matter of outward obedience. Looking back, along came this peasant, this carpenter's son, this Jesus from Nazareth, who said something very different than what most everyone had previously believed. He did not challenge, nor did he dismiss, the absolute importance of those 613 instructions. They were utterly righteous. But this Jesus said that from your outright and wholesale commitment to what Moses said, there is something that you must learn about yourself, something you must conclude having invested yourself entirely in what God had said. In a sentence, you need help. And this Jesus, this unsightly one, having come from the backwoods of Nazareth, had the audacity to proclaim that he, of all the people, not only understood that help was required, but that he was the help. Impossible. For 3 years, Jesus traveled the land of Israel, explaining to everyone who would listen how it was, who it was, that God had declared, even in the very words of what was given to Moses, that these people God had chosen to be among that God had chosen to be among would actually reap his reward promised long ago. It would come through the one standing there telling them about it. This was the help he said they needed. At that time, very few actually believed him. Ironically, even his own family, and notably his oldest brother James, at first did not believe him at all. For the first 30 years of his life, they lived with him. And while we know very little of what that was like, clearly it did not particularly impress his family. Later, that would change. But there were some who did believe him, and we know them as to be his apostles. 12 men, well, actually 11, who traveled, listened, muffed, mistaked, retreated, but ultimately embraced everything Jesus said. While with them, Jesus said he was teaching them, but he also said that soon he would be, that they would be on their own, save the Holy Spirit, and it was up to them to continue his mission of delivering this news of help to anyone who would listen. And deliver they did, some to their own people, the Jews, and some to those who previously had been left outside, the Gentiles. And the news spread, and it stuck, and quickly became a movement, the Jesus movement, the way. But as the movement grew, three things occurred that created trouble and ultimately thwarted what today we call Christianity. Number one, many of the expectations held by those who had believed Jesus and his apostles wasn't coming to pass. Namely, the kingdom of God had not come, and Rome was still bearing down. Was it true after all? Two, the establishment, too, was bearing down hard on those who were standing by these promises made by Jesus and his apostles. Why? Because not only did they not believe what Jesus and his apostles were saying, but those who did believe it were upsetting the proverbial apple cart of the day by giving Rome a reason to pay a little closer attention to these troublesome Jews and maybe even take some, if not all, of their comfortable autonomy away. Not good. And three, a whole bunch of Gentiles were jumping on board, and no good Jew could ever accept that God ever intended to include these Gentile dogs in the story God was telling about them. It couldn't be so. So what does a good Jew do? Dispel the story and marginalize or even eliminate those who believe it. Simply make it go away. And so we go back to 40 or 60 AD into the center of everything Jewish, smack dab in Jerusalem. Like most everywhere else, the Jesus movement had set in, only in Jerusalem, it seems it had both a stronger hold, or at least a more significant place, and it was taking bigger hits. For the center of the establishment, those most threatened, was, of course, in Jerusalem. Times were very, very tenuous. So that's the setting or so for the way this book is written. Clearly, trouble was brewing or had brewed, and people were frustrated, and life was not going well, and this particular man, James, was addressing that. I won't go into a whole lot of detail about how I think this thing is put together, but I will say a few things to remind you that whether I'm right or not, I don't know, but I am more and more convinced that what this book is, back in that day, the tradition, the sort of thing that happened in all the synagogues around the area was the rabbi would come in on the Shabbat, on Sabbath, and he would teach, and they would all read the same verse, same passage out of their Old Testament. Everybody still does that, if you didn't know that, on each and every Sabbath, the same passages read all over the world on the same day. And then after that, the rabbi would make his comments, preach, if you will, on the passage of the particular day. James was the rabbi in Jerusalem, pillar of the Jerusalem church. He would have been the teacher, probably, most of the time, maybe all of the time, in that particular church. And so he read, like everybody read, the passage of the day. I think what he was doing, why we get James, is he was reading, doesn't matter what it's called, there's a name for it, it's Leviticus 19, the whole chapter to the early part of 21. That was the passage that was being read, and James, like all the rabbis, read it, and then he taught on it. And what I'm convinced of is that what this book represents is sermon notes. His apostles or disciples, James's disciples, were sitting just like you are today, listening to him, and they were writing notes about what he had said, and they compiled those notes into what we have now, I think, as the book of James. That's called a Yalkut or a Yalkut. And it really is just a compilation of notes, sermons, if you will. James wouldn't have been the only one to do this, not the first and not the last, but that's what I think this is. That's why I think it's in the format, the sort of confusing sort of structure that we have. No clear argument. I think there is an argument, but no clear argument, nothing at all like the epistles. Nothing that lets you just sort of analyze and break down what it is that James is trying to say based on the structure of the argument. It's just a lot more random. Well, it's not random entirely, but it's random compared to the other stuff that we see in the Bible. And I think that's because it is one sermon on top of another sermon on top of another sermon that feels like it's sort of all over the place, but there's a thread. We've seen some of that already, and that thread is there on purpose. I think when James is teaching, he's addressing the situation he's seeing in Jerusalem in his own synagogue and his own body of believers. His disciples turn around and recognize that this is useful for anybody and everybody in the diaspora, which is why the beginning of the book says, to all the Jews in the diaspora. So while I think James is speaking directly to his congregation, if you will, the disciples, his people, have come back and said, this is meaningful for everybody. Everybody needs to hear this. So it's a letter that goes out to the many, not just the body in Jerusalem. But I think it's likely that the comments that James is making are specific to his audience. And I think that because there are some very specific things he's addressing. And I don't think he'd know that from the folks in wherever, Galatia or Colossae, or name your church or synagogue. I don't think he would understand what was going on, nor would he have any reason to know what was going on there. He knew what was going on in his body and his congregation. So these are personal remarks, I think. These are things that he sees and he's addressing in his own people. A few things just to remember about James, the author. This is probably the brother of Jesus. It doesn't have to be James, the brother of Jesus, but it's likely that it is. There's a couple of other options. It doesn't really matter. It's not relevant who they are. James, the brother of Jesus, almost certainly James, the pillar of the church in Jerusalem, as I have been saying. James was an apostle. He wasn't one of the original 12, but we know that he was an apostle because there are references in the New Testament by other authors as James the apostle. So he spoke authoritatively. He didn't identify himself, oddly enough, in the beginning of his letter. Many people ask, why didn't he identify himself? And my conviction is he didn't need to. If I'm right about what was going on here, he was just writing to people who knew him. There wouldn't have been any reason to say he was James, the brother of Jesus, the apostle of the church, blah, blah, blah. So he doesn't identify himself, and I don't think that's problematic necessarily. As I mentioned, James was not one of the original 12, but he was considered an apostle. It clearly mattered to be James. There are lots of mentions in the New Testament about James and what a pious man he was and references to James. James was a big deal. What James said mattered a lot. You might recall that Paul goes to Jerusalem to get basically a mark of authenticity on his message, and he gets that mark from James while in Jerusalem. So James was worth listening to for sure. As I mentioned, James was written sometime between 40 and 60 AD. There's debate about that. I'm not sure it really matters, but I think that's probably pretty right on the timeline, and that's one of the earlier letters we have in the New Testament. There's three perspectives people have on this book. One is it really is just a random bit of stuff, just throwing stuff at the wall, hoping some of it sticks. That's frankly the way most people take it, that it's more like Proverbs than it is anything that we find in the New Testament. The other thing that people oftentimes say is that just as James basically recalling and then reciting things that he remembers Jesus saying from the Sermon on the Mount. And there's a ton of reasons why that actually makes some sense. Lots of the things that James speaks about are reminiscent of things that Jesus says on the Sermon on the Mount. Many of the same quotes are used as the Sermon on the Mount. That's possible, and it wouldn't wreck anything I have to say if that's true. But the third one that I mentioned is this notion of a yalkut, which more specifically on Leviticus 19. And I won't go through all of the places. I'll mention a couple of them today, I think, later on. But there are tons of quotes from Leviticus 19 and 20 in James. Quotes. What I mean by that is specific wording from Leviticus 19 and 20. Like 10 or 12. More than that even. There's a bunch. So here's the way that one of the authors that I didn't read very many guys, there aren't that many good authors about this book, but here's what one of them said, a Messianic Jew. The book of James was a collection of highlights from the sermons of the chief rabbi of Jerusalem's Messianic community. James gave these sermon talks on Sabbath during which the ending section of the book of Leviticus was being studied. Maybe the last thing I'll mention just to remind you that James was one of the last books accepted into the Bible. Lots of people didn't like it. They didn't like it for two main reasons. They didn't like it because it didn't say Jesus, ever, which is interesting. And they didn't like it because of the works, the highlight on works instead of faith. That's a big problem. And Luther was one of the big opponents of James as being a part of the canon. He later decided it did belong. It was worthy of reading, probably belonged, but he gave it his blessing. Okay, that's enough background of James, I think. I'm going to try to get through verses 11 through 17 of chapter 4. That's where we ended when the last time I was here. Let me read those, and then I'm going to make some comments before we get to the text. But let me read it for the record. Verse 11, James chapter 4, do not speak evil of one another, brothers. The one who speaks evil of a brother or is passing judgment on his brother slanders the law and passes judgment on the law. But if you pass judgment on the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge. One is a lawgiver and judge, the one who is able to save and to destroy. But who are you, the one judging a neighbor? Come now, the one saying, today or tomorrow we will go into this city and do this for a year, and engage in business and prosper. You do not know whatever about tomorrow. What is your life? For you are a vapor, appearing for a short while then disappearing. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, indeed, we will live and do this or that. But now you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, the one having come to know what is good and does not do it, is guilty of sin. You might remember, looking back to this chapter, if maybe you don't remember, but I argued and still will argue that the primary issue, the thing that James is mostly concerned with, is believers, so-called believers, believers in Jesus, Jewish believers in Jesus, that were frustrated with their life. Things were not going well for a number of reasons, but probably mostly because of the persecution of the Orthodox Jews, the non-believing Jews, that were not happy with the way that the believing Jews were living their lives and not happy with the frustration that they were causing in general for the lives of the establishment, so to speak. So their lives were frustrating. It wasn't going well. And it appears that because of that, they started to question, well, they definitely started to question what they believed about Jesus, but they started to question how they were going to live their lives in light of what they believed. They didn't like the way things were going. They looked across the street to other brothers and sisters, probably believers, and saw what they had. Things were going better for them than it was going for them, and they decided to do something about it on their own. Take matters into their own hand, figure out a way to go and take or find a way to take advantage of what was somebody else's in order to better themselves. Mostly it appears that what they were interested was in power, in authority, in some kind of position in the community. So not so much wishing they had other people's stuff, but wishing they had other people's stature, other people's position, other people's place in the community. And so they're negotiating life in such a way that tries to elevate themselves and take down the people that they are trying to take the place of. That's what we've been hearing for the whole book of James. I mean, that's not the only thing we're hearing in the book of James, but that's the most recent thing we've been looking at in the book of James. And I think that in most recently in this chapter, early on in verses 1 up to this point, that's exactly what we were looking at. So-called believers that were fighting. So if I'm right about that, then they are pursuing in the world, or what they are pursuing in their world, is at odds, entirely at odds, with what actually matters. And they're at odds with the true, genuine, real pursuit of God, which is what James would have said they were supposed to be doing. As I was studying this stuff, I threw that phrase out there, the pursuit of God. And I started writing my notes all about what that was. And I just stopped for a minute and I said, wait a minute. I throw that around a lot. What is that? What does it look like to actually be in pursuit of God? I don't know if you've ever actually thought about that. Maybe all of you haven't. I'm the only one who hasn't. But I had to stop and think for a while about what that actually meant. I turned 55 this summer, and for whatever reason, that feels like a milestone. I don't know why. 50 probably was supposed to be, but 55 seems a lot older. And in some weird way, it started to feel like 55 sort of on the way down. On the way up, I'm kind of winding things down. And I don't know, maybe, I mean, well, it's certainly true. My life is more than half over, but things feel a little bit like they're closer to the end than the beginning. And for whatever reason, that makes me stop for a minute and take a little bit of stock. And again, ask myself the question, okay, you're over halfway into this thing. You talk a lot about the pursuit of God, and it means a lot to you. What is it? Define it. So I've tried to do that. And I don't know if I'm right or not. I don't think I'm wrong. There's probably more ways to define the pursuit of God. But I've come up with something that has been helpful for me, and I want to share it with you. I hope it's helpful for you. And ultimately, I think this relates to what James would say about what it means to be someone who is truly in the pursuit of God. The things that normally come to my mind when I ask myself, am I in the pursuit of God? The things that just sort of pop up that all my life I've sort of fallen back and answered the question, yeah, I'm pursuing God, and I bet many of you have said the same thing, are sort of the obvious things, unfortunately, the trap things. Are you studying enough? Are you praying enough? Are you giving enough? All that stuff. Going to church, singing's loud enough, whatever. All those traps that tend to be the definition or the defining ways that people look to be to answer the question pursuing God. But I'm not sure any of those are the pursuit of God. For me, those, however, are all measurements. Those are all ways for me to take stock. I found something interesting about myself this year. I took a test. It was for work. And it was one of those personality tests, one of those strengths and weakness things. I forget the main one that Briggs and something or other. Not Briggs and Stratton, that's something like that. So I took one of those, a couple of us did, and working through some personnel stuff at work. So I took one of those, and it lists the 30 strengths you have, from the most dominant thing about you to the least dominant thing about you. And then it describes all the things about that most dominant thing about you. And the most dominant thing in mine, by a long shot, was that I'm somebody they call an achiever. I have to achieve something. And Susie can attest to this. This was striking to me that it listed out, this is the way they describe this when you get your results back. It says, you are somebody that must achieve something every day. Mm-hmm. You are somebody who is entirely unhappy if you've gone through your day and you can't look back and find something that you achieved. Mm-hmm. You are somebody that even has to achieve something on weekends and on vacation. I mean, it is absolutely true. I was a little scary. And so it was no surprise to me as I was asking myself, how do I decide whether I'm in the pursuit of God, that what I would fall back on is achievements, things that I could look at and go, okay, I've achieved it, therefore I must have done something. But I don't think any of those things are right, obviously. I hope that's obvious. They can be helpful, they can be useful, they can be guidance, but they're not the measurement of the pursuit of God. They can be testing, but they are not decisive. I decided there's something else that's decisive, the actual determiner of who and what I am about, the thing that determines whether I am in authentic pursuit of God. And it's not at all surprising, I suppose, that it is Jesus who makes this abundantly clear. This is what Jesus says. This will not be a surprise to you either. But when the Pharisees heard that he had put the Sadducees to silence, they gathered themselves together, and one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, testing him, "Teacher, what's the greatest commandment in the law?" And he said to him, "You should love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the greatest and the foremost commandment, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend the entire law and the prophets." So love God. That's what you're supposed to do. That's what it means to pursue God. And how does one love God? What does that actually look like? I think that's why there's the second part of that. How do you physically love God? Well, you love your neighbor. That's why he says the second one is like it. You love your neighbor. And how exactly does one love your neighbor? That's a fundamental question. How do you do that? And I think the answer is spelled out for us too. There are several ways to answer that. Here's the way I find very helpful to answer that question. Jesus isn't the one who answers for us. The prophet Micah answers that for us. Micah 6, this is a familiar passage to all of you, 6 through 8. With what shall I come to the Lord and how? With what shall I come to the Lord and bow myself before the God on high? Shall I come to him with burnt offerings, with yearly calves? Does the Lord take delight in 1,000 rams, in 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I present my firstborn for my rebellious acts, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? Micah says, he has told you, O man, what is good and what does the Lord require of you, but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God. Justice, mercy, and humility. If I am in pursuit of God, I mean actually one who truly has a heart that's oriented towards God, a heart that God has touched, if I have eyes to see and if I have ears to hear, and I truly love him with all my heart, with all my soul, and with all my mind, then it is in my treatment, my attitudes, and my actions towards others that will manifest my belief. It is those things that will determine whether I am in the pursuit of God. I'm not sure there's ever been a time in history that this sort of thing has been more meaningful. It is in my interactions with my neighbor, those that I say I love, that I will do justice, and I will love mercy, and I will walk humbly. If I don't do those things, then I'm no believer at all. And I'm certainly not in pursuit of God. If I'm right about this, that is to say, if I'm right about loving your neighbor, which ultimately fulfills all the law and the prophets, and that loving your neighbor can be defined by doing justice, loving mercy, and walking humbly, then it seems to me to know what these things are is sort of important. Justice. It's a word that's used 249 times as a noun in the Bible. And it gets translated both justice and judgment, or a rendering. There's a verb form of it too, and it's to judge. This word seems, at least it seems to me, this word seems to come down to deciding rightly about people. Not a thumbs up or a thumbs down, but rather that simply as people, they are owed our respect and our honor. Doing justice does not seem to imply that it is making sure that everybody has the same, but rather it is seeing and treating everybody as the same. That's very, very different. And it is very different than the political world and the religious world, both that I have been a part of, that is touting, preaching, and holding out their social justice. That world, at least as I've experienced, is all about equalizing what people have, demonizing those who have much. In other words, they see as fundamentally wrong that some have more and use that notion of human equality to achieve the goal of experiential equality. I think this flies in the face of what the Bible actually says about justice, and especially about God's prerogative to write the story in any way that he sees fit. And I was thinking about this, and I don't want you to take this wrong. There can be something really wrong with having a lot, but it's not that you have a lot that's wrong. It's how you have a lot that can be wrong and that can be an injustice. But it's not that we have that is injustice. The biblical issue is never that someone has. The biblical issue is how someone has. And the biblical issue is never that someone doesn't have. The biblical issue is why someone doesn't have. James has actually addressed both of these issues already for us. He has talked extensively about what we as believers will do with the fact that God is the author of everything and we are not. Specifically, how we're going to see the trials and the tests that God has authored that are centered around us dealing with what we don't have and what we do want. One of those central themes of James is dealing with how people were treating others differently, that is, the rich and the poor, those with much and those with little. The implication, it seems to me, is that they were actually seeing them as different kinds of people. They had different value. Rich people had more value than poor people, and that's exactly what doing justice isn't doing. If we look back to Micah, that is where the most notable do justice is found. What's going on in Micah is that there were very wealthy people who were seeing what very poor people had, their property, and they were going to take it. And they were going to take it not so much because they thought that they wanted the property, but they were taking it because they put no value on the people that owned it. They were just meaningless people. They didn't care about the other people. They saw them as not worthy of any justice. So in the pursuit of God, if I'm not rightly viewing people, all people, for who and for what they are, then I am not pursuing God. I'm just not. Justice, then, is not finding ways to be sure that everybody has the same thing. It is holding to the fundamental belief that everybody is the same, and maybe most importantly, that I am no better than anyone else, and I am to treat everyone as I would want to be treated. That, I think, is justice. That's, I think, what it means to do justice. What is mercy then? How do you do mercy? If we love justice, how do we do mercy? If I am right about what justice means, then there is a fundamental belief that I will, and I have that fundamental belief, that I will love God with all my heart, soul, mind, and strength, and I will consequently love my neighbor as myself, then there are at least two implications of that with respect to loving. Loving not getting what one deserves, and I should have defined what mercy is before then. Mercy is not getting what you probably should have gotten, not getting what you deserve. Those two ways, two implications of that. One with respect to God. If I love mercy, if I truly love mercy, then I love and I am embracing and I am committed to that God is a God who can and will withhold judgment. That's what it means to love mercy with respect to God. He will withhold judgment, and it's judgment that I clearly deserve. There is nothing that is more valuable to love. I think this is what we would refer to as profound gratefulness. And then secondly, as a result of that, it seems to me that with respect to others now, not with God, as respect to others, those that I am committed to treating as I would want to be treated, that I'm committed to extending them the same kind of mercy that I've been extended. I think Jesus is the one who said it best, "Forgive them, for they don't know what they do." It is in the recognition and the accompanying action from truly understanding that the receipt of mercy requires the extension of mercy. We must be a forgiving people. This is what loving mercy means. There's no better example at all of loving mercy than when Jesus said, like I said, "Forgive them, Father, for they don't know what they do." This is a minute I want to take to look at the Lord's Prayer, not for very long at all, but I think that there's a mistake that we've made. I know I've made it with what the Lord's Prayer actually is trying to communicate. And oddly enough, it's the last verse of the prayer that nobody ever reads. Certainly it isn't the one that we recite when we're reciting the Lord's Prayer. And there may be something about the Lord's Prayer you don't know and that I'll tell you today that may or may not be helpful for you. Pray then this way: Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give me this day my daily bread, and forgive me my sins as I forgive those who have sinned against me. Lead me not into temptation, but deliver me from evil. What's next? No, it's not. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever and ever. Amen. Well, but that's not even there in the original or the earliest manuscripts. Did you know that? Here's what comes next. Let me read 13 again. And do not lead us into temptation, but to deliver us from evil. For if you do not forgive men, then your Father will not forgive your transgressions. I've never heard anybody else say this, and Ron's not here. I know he disagrees with me on this. I actually think the entire Lord's Prayer is about forgiveness. I think that's the point of the prayer. All the way to the top, even about bread, all that stuff. I think that's all about forgiveness. Because at the end of the prayer, the big crescendo is what you're supposed to get here is if you're not a person who's merciful, you're not getting mercy. That's sort of a huge deal. And I think all that other stuff above it is leading to this conclusion that, by the way, knock, knock, mercy is something you should be extraordinarily concerned with as a believer. Recognizing the mercy that you've been given requires you to extend it to others. And if you're not somebody who extends mercy to others, you won't get mercy. There's nothing more profound. Now, if you want to go ahead and say, "For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever and ever, amen," go right ahead. I do it too. Just know there's another verse, and you probably ought to stick that in your memory verse for the week. I think that's a big deal. Love, do justice, which leads to loving mercy, which leads to walking humbly. The last of the three measurements, if you will, of the pursuit of God. What does it mean to walk humbly? I think that means, based on some of the work that I've done, that it is being prepared to be proceeding with the Lord your God. Prepared to be proceeding with the Lord your God. I think this has in mind the notion that we conduct our lives with respect to justice and mercy, with this understanding, this conviction, that we will one day give an account before God. We are to carefully consider how we are living our lives, knowing that we will stand before God accountable for how we've thought of and how we've treated others. Nobody's going to ask how many days we went to church. Nobody's going to ask how many times we prayed. Nobody's going to ask how much money we gave. They might ask how we treated others. They just might. He might. This is where I think we get the translation of walking humbly. If we understand justice and we understand mercy, there's no other way we could walk than to walk humbly, prepared to meet God and give an account. Interestingly enough, a couple of weeks ago, I was having a beer with a friend of mine who's never asked me a question ever about what I believe. I've known this guy forever. And I was smack dab in the middle of this study. And we're sitting there, and he looks at me and says, "Rusty, how do I know if I've done enough?" And I said, "What? How do I know? If I'm going to meet God one day, how do I know if I've done enough?" And I looked at him and I said, "It's funny you ask. I've been thinking about that a lot. And here's how I would answer that question. Do you love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength? Yeah. How about your neighbor? Do you love your neighbor as yourself? How would I know? Well, you start by doing justice and then loving mercy and walking humbly." And then we had a really, really long conversation and another beer. It's incredibly relevant, it seems to me. And at least in my life, maybe not yours, but I've said a million times that James, I think, is the practical sort of, there's all this Torah stuff. How do you live? Like, how do I do what I believe? And for me, this question of the pursuit of God and how to do that, when it comes down to it, I find over and over and over and over again, ultimately the only thing that matters is how I'm interacting with other people. What am I doing with other people? And how am I responding to them? And how do I think about me in light of these other people? And it comes down for me to justice, mercy, and humility. I hope James would agree with that. I don't know. I think he would. But if he agreed with that, and if he were to say that, that's the background that James has in mind as he is instructing the people that he is writing or sermoning to, and others are writing those sermons down. That's his backdrop. That's the way that he sees people as supposed to have been living. That's how he thinks they're to be interacting with others, and he's certainly not seeing that interaction in his world that he's writing into. He's seeing everything but that, which is why he's writing. He's not seeing justice, he's clearly not seeing mercy, and he's obviously not seeing humility. He's seeing the opposite of those things, which is what he's speaking to. So, we'll go to the text now, and probably get through it just in time to not leave time for questions, which is my goal. Verse 11, "Do not speak evil of one another, brothers. The one who speaks evil of a brother is passing judgment, or is passing judgment on his brother, slanders the law and passes judgment on the law. But if you pass judgment on the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge." I just want to notice here that this is one of the places that has very, very striking similarities to Leviticus 19. Let me read it just so you can put that into context. Leviticus 19, 15, 16, and 17 say, "You shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor defer to the great, but you are to judge your neighbor fairly. You shall not go about as a slanderer among people, and you are not to act against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. You shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. You may surely reprove your neighbor, but shall not incur sin because of him. Very, very strikingly similar language. There's just no doubt in my mind James had this in mind. He had to have it in mind, which is what makes me convinced that this is part of what James is doing, or the book of James is speaking to this sermon on Leviticus 19. If we were to go back and look at verse 1, we would remember that this is no doubt still a part of a discussion concerning people who had been waging war with one another, as I said, to gain this power, this prestige, and this position. It's not at all clear exactly what James has in mind. We don't know the exact circumstances that he's speaking into, but the situation in general is not hard to imagine, nor is it hard to see what James is speaking about. Somebody wants something that someone else has, or they're vying for it. Ultimately, I think what they're trying to do is make their life better. Rather than leave that outcome to God, the one who ultimately decides outcomes like that, they're going to take the process into their own hands. That's what James is looking at them doing. They're taking God's role into their own hands. And how does one, if they want what somebody else has, and they don't have it and they can't get it, how does one go about taking it? If it's power, prestige, and position, how do you get that? Unfortunately, I know a lot too much about that, how to vie for power, prestige, and position. I know it personally, and I've watched a ton of it. How do you do it? By taking the other guy down. That's how you do it. And there's no better example than the election process. You say anything and everything to take the guy down. Character assassination. Say whatever you need to say to take the other guy out. Passing judgment, which is what James is saying here, it's the language that he uses, passing judgment seems to be something along the lines of rendering someone unworthy or unfit for what they have and what they are. That word that's do not speak evil, that's one of the ways to translate that or to render that is someone asks you to give an account or to criminate somebody else. It is the process of taking someone down verbally. Come on, there we go. What I don't think this is a prohibition on speaking against another person, say, for example, for legal reasons. This is a prohibition on character assassination. This is a prohibition on propping yourself up at the expense of somebody else. This is a prohibition on dropping those little nuggets, those little somethings that just diminish somebody else just a little bit and lift you up just a little bit. Or a bigger nugget that takes somebody all the way down at the knees and props you up as high as the mountaintops can take you. And I've seen and done both. While it may be that we're not in the business of telling lies about others, we are certainly in the business of slander, which is what James is speaking to. So how is this criminating, this rendering or giving an account of somebody else, how is that passing judgment on the law? That's what James says it is. And I think this is a rendering of the law of God as unimportant. What God says is irrelevant. What God says is bothersome. What God said doesn't really matter. One who ignores these instructions, the ones that God has gave, remember they were being read aloud in the synagogue, is effectively announcing, as they're taking their neighbor down, they're announcing that such things that God says is important, they're not worthy of one's attention. They just don't matter. To not slander somebody, which God says you're not supposed to do, doesn't matter. I'm going to do it anyway because I don't have what I want and he has it, so I'm going to slander to get it. And by saying so, by saying that one is unworthy and I am worthy, is also saying that God is unworthy. He's unworthy to decide, which is a ginormous problem. James is highlighting and elevating what it actually means when you simply ignore what is right. You know what's right and you ignore it. In this Jewish context, one that held absolutely nothing in higher esteem and importance than Torah and its life-giving message, the one who simply ignores its instructions is not only guilty of a violation of the law, they're guilty of tossing the whole thing aside, which is exactly what James is warning that they shouldn't be doing. They are not a doer, but rather they are rendering what they should be doing as unworthy. And this is what I think James was referring to earlier on when he said, "For whoever keeps the whole law yet stumbles in one point becomes guilty of all of it." Verse 12. One is the lawgiver and judge, one with a capital O, the one who is able to save and to destroy. But who are you, the one judging a number, the one judging a neighbor? James doesn't seem to be saying anything here that everyone in the whole room who was listening didn't already know. God is the one who created right and wrong. That's not a surprise to anybody. He is the determiner of everything good. He is the determiner of everything bad. He is the one who declared for his people what should and should not be so. And he is the one, he is the only one who has the right to render a decision about anybody as to whether one is worthy or not to receive honor, dignity, and grace. Only God decides that. And of course, one God, only one God, the one God, is ultimately in the position to rescue or to destroy in the most ultimate sense. No man is ever in that position. Which is why James says, one is able to save and destroy. But who are you? The one judging a neighbor. James is putting them in their place. Verse 13, James says, "Come now, the one saying, today or tomorrow we will go into the city and we will do this or we will do that and we will engage in business and will prosper. You do not know whatever about tomorrow. What is your life? For you are vapor, swirl of smoke, appearing for a short while, then disappearing. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, indeed, we will live, then we will do this or we will do that." I don't know if you've heard sermons on this passage. I've heard a lot of them. I think I've taught on this passage, and everything I ever said I think was wrong about it. This is really not a passage about good planning or a prohibition against setting goals or making decisions about how you want your life to go. I don't think any of that's really in mind here. The discussion is taking things into your own hands that belong to God. And I think this is just a practical way that James uses to highlight how silly it is the way we decide to play God. It is an example given to paint the real-life picture of leaving up to God what is God's to decide. I can say that I'm going to go and do this or that, but ultimately that's not my call. It's God's call whether I'm going to go do this or that. I don't get to decide that. I can set the goal, I can make the plan, but I have to recognize, realize, and embrace the fact that God is in charge of what I'm going to do, and I have to own that. There's a number of things in here that are worth probably sermons on their own about, but I'm just going to highlight a few things that I think are interesting. First of all, you do not know whatever about tomorrow. This is not some sort of slam on our intellect, like you don't know crap. That's not what he's saying. Rather, it's a reminder that tomorrow is utterly out of your control. Utterly out of your control. In my opinion, this is the most frightful or the most comforting thing about being a believer. On the one hand, to acknowledge that our destiny is absolutely in the hands of God is terrifying. At least it is for me. Terrifying because I am a control freak. I'm going to make decisions about my life, and only me am going to make decisions about my life. And if I actually believe this stuff, if I actually take to heart what this Bible tells me, this stuff is completely outside of my control, utterly out of my control. God is writing the script in any way he sees fit. Terrifying. Terrifying. On the one hand. On the other hand, if you can actually own that, And if you actually believe when Romans says that all things work together for good for those who are in Christ Jesus, that if God is actually who he says he is, if he really is the good God that he claims himself to be, and I really am one of his chosen for eternity to be along his side, if that's actually true, then every single solitary, minuscule piece of life that I have to live is for my own good, and God is absolutely working it into my best interest. It's unbelievably freeing. So I can be terrified, rightfully so, or I can be completely free. It just has to do with my perspective on God and me, which is the lifelong goal of being a believer. I still have this terrible fear when my kids or when Susie are not at home and they're driving home. I'm sure they're going to get in a wreck. I'm just sure of it. Because I'm also an eternal pessimist, but that's not healthy either. But I'm just positive they're going to get in a wreck. And something terrible is going to happen. And so the boys don't live at home anymore, but when it used to be when I would get home and they weren't home, or when I get home and Susie's not home and she should be, I start pacing around and what's going to happen? Where are the kids? Where's Susie? And I go out and I'll listen to see if I can hear for the car coming. I'm a mess. And I just have to stop and say, wait, what are you doing? If I'm really one who believes this stuff, then God is every bit as in control of Susie's and Trevor and Tyler's life as he is mine, and he's working this all out. I don't have anything to worry about, but I am just a mess because I'm just terrified God is going to do something terrible in my life. But the fact of the matter is God is in charge of my life. He can do whatever he wants, and I am convinced that he is doing what he intends to do for good. And if I am convinced of that and I believe that and I live that out, life is very different than the terrifying one of pacing around wondering where the next terrible thing is going to come. When we can embrace and enjoy and own the authority and the sovereignty that God has, I think coming to the point where we can embrace it is what the Bible would call maturity. I just think that's where what a mature believer comes to understand and lives their life in the light of it. It is hard, it seems to me, very hard, but I think that's maybe one of the greatest successes we will ever have as believers. And I think it's the hardest with our kids, at least in our lives. It's the hardest with our kids, letting God own our kids as much as he can own our lives. James says, what is your life? That's a funny thing. It would be easy to see that as a sort of slam, like a little condescending, your life ain't nothing. But I don't think that's what James really has in his mind or he intends it. I think he means more along the lines of put your life in perspective. Just stop for a minute and put your life in perspective. In the grand scheme of things, you are here today and you're gone tomorrow. You just are. You're here today, you're gone tomorrow. During that time, in that little speck of time, understand who you are. Understand where you stand with respect to God. Put your life in perspective. What is your life? It is not that you don't matter. It is that you matter only because God has determined that you matter. And in the context of time and history, his determination of your life is just really small. It just is. Which for some of us like me, that's a hard pill to swallow, but it just is so. Your life is just not that big a deal. But it is big in the sense that God has determined it so, and you're to live your life as God has determined your life to be so. So in that respect, it's a huge deal. There's nothing huger. But in the grand scheme of things, we're a speck. And then he uses this funny little thing, for you are a vapor. One other way to take that is a swirl of smoke arising from a fire for a short while and then disappearing. This is a super interesting analogy. It happened to be as I was studying this, we were camping and I was watching the fire, and you have all done it too, watching the swirls of smoke. And It's very interesting. The fire is producing millions of these, never ending. I mean, as long as you keep putting wood on it, the swirls of smoke never stop, ever, ever, ever. And they start with these beautiful sort of thick swirls of smoke, right? And they go round and round, and they're super cool to watch, and they're all kind of mingled together, and all this stuff is happening. And then as they go up, it just disappear, and then whoo, gone. Out of sight. No longer to ever exist again. Go back down to the fire. Here comes some more. And I was just thinking, okay, well, which one's me? Gone. Fascinating. I don't know if James had that in mind, but I mean, it totally made sense to me. It's like, yeah, I get it. I mean, for a minute, for a second, in the eternal production of the fire, for a second, kind of a big deal. I mean, that's the smoke out of the fire. That's what it's producing. But it's pretty short-lived. And up it goes, and away it goes, never to return again. The other interesting thing, just as I noticed, I don't think any two vapors are alike, right? I mean, every one of them is a little different. Every single one of those is different. You're a vapor appearing for a short while. Quickly then, the last few verses here. Instead, he says, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, indeed, we should live, or we will live, and we will do this or do that. Not a super complicated idea, but a simple admission that this is all simply not up to us. This is an understanding and statement of humility and clarity. God and God alone determines the course and the details of my life. And this is not saying that there is anything wrong with taking direction or making a plan or stepping out on a particular course. We are simply to understand and embrace that God truly is authoring our every move. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will do this or we will do that. I find myself saying that a lot. Lord willing. Think about that for a minute. That's actually true. Lord willing, this or that. Lord not willing, not so much this or that. It's pretty profound. And one of those things is like, oh yeah, if the Lord wills. Or the creeks don't rise. Is that how it goes? Thanks. It was Jack who said that in an email one time. What are you talking about? I'd never heard that before. Oh, I see. It's a song. But now, he says, you boast in your arrogance or your pretension, and all such boasting is evil. This boasting and arrogance clearly is suggesting that somehow, aside from God, you have control and you are the one directing your course of life. Again, I think this is different from planning and setting goals and just prudent living. This is operating on the assumption and the belief that it is I and only I who control my destiny. And remember, this is to people who know better. They know a lot better. They know especially from their own history, and they all knew their own history, it wasn't that long ago for them, that God and only God is the determiner of life. God has said so over and over and over again in their own history, in their own lives, in their own scripture. Exodus is maybe the best example of God determining the life of his people. Job, Psalms, Jonah, on and on it goes. God determines the destiny of his people. That is not a surprise to anybody in the audience that James is speaking to. And James is warning against people taking the position that somehow they, not God, have the ultimate power and authority over their own lives. James says, this is evil. It's not just stupid, it's evil to take the matters into your own hands. Why? Why is it evil? Why is questioning the sovereignty of God evil and not just stupid? Well, I think a better word than evil might be wicked, or even better yet, a reproach. That is an expression of disapproval. An attitude of autonomy from God is saying that I know better. I am in a better position to decide about my life than you are, God. You are not in the position to know better than me. And more specifically, God, I do not like how you are suggesting things are going or should go. And ultimately, God, you are not trustworthy. You are not trustworthy, you are not safe, and you are not good. That's why it's evil. This is the creature saying to the Creator, don't tell me. Don't tell me. That, I think, is why it is evil. That's why it's a reproach. That's why it's not good. And then last, therefore, he says, the one having come to know what is good and does not do it is guilty of sin. This is a very interesting take on sin. I won't go into it because we're out of time. We would normally think of sin as all the things that we might do that God says we're not supposed to, like stealing and lusting and lying and all those other things, but this is a little different. This is knowing what is right, that is to say, knowing how God has instructed us to think and to think differently than the way God has instructed us to think. That's sin. That's separation from God. That, James says, is death. I will read this last little bit, and then we will be done. So what is the point? What's the point of this section? What does James want us to know? I think he wants us to know that life circumstances and our view of those circumstances do not inform who and what God is. Our circumstances do not inform who or what God is. They do inform who we are insofar as how we approach those circumstances. That says everything about how we view God. And one of the most telling of those circumstances and our reaction to them, maybe the most telling in those circumstances, is how we think and treat other people. For it is in that treatment of others that we lay bare what we really think about God, which is a scary thought, to be sure. I've successfully left no time. I will, if you have questions or comments about that, save them for next week, or please email them to me, and we will have more time the next couple of verses here to talk about that. So thank you very much.